Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank them both up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank them both up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank them both up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. Now let me get this straight. You put the lime in the coconut, you drank them both up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank them both up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank them both up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called your doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, Doctor, yes, you put the lime in the coconut, you drink and pour it up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drink and pour it up. Put our lime in the coconut and drink and pour together. Put the lime in the coconut, then you feel better. Put the lime in the coconut and drink and pour it down. Put our lime in the coconut and call me in the morning.
Welcome to Steady Health Radio. I'm your host, Robert Reister. We're coming to you today and every Tuesday at 11 Eastern, 10 Central, 8 Pacific, 1600 GMT on the BBS Radio Network Channel 1. In a few minutes, we'll open up the line so that you can call in questions and comments from North America at 888-627-6008. And if you are outside of North America, you can't use Skype today, but you can call in to whatever your country code is for the United States, plus 530-327-7602. I'll repeat those numbers a little later in the show. First, I want to explain that on Steady Health Radio, a lot of what we do is to give you the information that your doctors don't tell you. But today, we're going to give you some information that the environmentalists don't tell you. And to help me do that, I have a very special guest, Dr. Dennis Schneider. Dr. Schneider is an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Microbiology at UT Austin. He's been teaching there since 1986. He's taught courses in biotech, introductory microbiology. He's teaching microbial ecology now. And he's a full-time director of research and development for a biotech firm in Texas that specializes in services to the oil field industry. And I know a lot of you have some predetermined ideas about how that works, but let's see if there isn't a different way of understanding. Dr. Schneider isn't just an oil and gas man. He isn't just a professor of biotechnology. He's also a scuba diver. He's an open water scuba instructor. He's also a member of Mensa. He's listed in Who's Who in America and Who in the World. I don't think he knows this yet. He's going to be in Wer ist Wer in the German version of Who's Who in the World, too. Dr. Schneider, this isn't all intellectual to you. You have a background. You grew up on a farm, didn't you?
That's right. I grew up on a farm in South Texas. And thank you for that very nice introduction, Robert. It's very flattering, but... And it's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. The reason to the farm is I'm a little bit biased since I grew up on a farm and maybe 40 miles away from you in South Texas, so I know a little about how that goes. It's not the kind of place where you can ignore nature.
It's true. I mean, farmers are all, they're right there at the ground floor, so to speak, of what's going on in the world. And they see firsthand the way things interact with each other, and I think it gives you gives you a different perspective about how the world works, for sure.
And you're also a scuba diver?
Yep, I've been a scuba diver since 1976, off and on. And that's been fun. I still haven't been too active lately in it, but I hope to get back into it again pretty soon. But one of my hobbies is fish identification. I work with a volunteer group called Reef, and we do survey work profiling fish populations on coral reefs, and that's been fun too.
And you also do some novels under the name Juana Doc.
Yep, that's just a kind of fun thing I like to do. I had some. I've had a lot of thoughts about how environmental problems could be solved in a perfect world, and decided to put those down on paper. So,
you're actually concerned about solving environmental problems in a perfect world, and that doesn't sound like somebody would be in the oil and gas industry. How did you get over to oil and gas?
Well, when I took this job, we were just getting into oil and gas work, and one of the themes of the company is we produce products that are environmentally safe to use in whatever application that they're used in, and we offer an alternative to oil field chemical use because our products are all natural bacterial products, and it's been a kind of a migration from that.
Welcome to Steady Health Radio again. We were experiencing a few technical difficulties, and we had to reconnect to my guest, Dr. Dennis Schneider. We were talking about the idea that you can frack an oil well without using chemicals. Is that right, Dr. Schneider?
You have to use chemicals. That's part of the procedure that's done. Now, just to kind of open things up, there's a lot of different ways fracking is done, okay? And the kind of classic way that fracking is done, and this kind of gets left out of a lot of discussions because the first thing people mention is chemicals, is that what you're really doing in a classic frack job, and there's a variation to this, and we can talk about that if you want later, is you're taking a solution of sand, okay? And by weight, the bulk of what goes into a frack is actually sand, okay? And you're gelling that with a natural polymer. The most common one used is guar, which is the gel that's used in ice cream and a lot of different food products. And you're also mixing in with that some chemicals in order to produce the right viscosity and right physical properties to carry out the frack, okay? The reason for this is when you inject fluids into an oil well, if they're not of a high enough viscosity, what will happen is the sand that's used will actually fall to the bottom of the oil well, and it'll be basically lost, and you won't get a frack, okay? So what they do is
you're making sand float.
Yeah, making sand float. And then that sand is pushed under very high pressure, high enough pressure to actually fracture the rock at a very specific place where they want to put it, and then that is pushed back into the oil-bearing formation. And you produce a void that's filled with sand that vastly increases the surface area that's producing hydrocarbon. Okay, you can think of it as breaking something open so that you can extract something out of it easier. Like if you took a rock and broke it open, it has a much higher surface area, and that's exactly what you're doing with a hydraulic fracturing process.
So you're kind of telling me that in an oil well that you don't just stick a straw into a big old pool of oil, or at least you can't do that anymore. The kind of oil that we get nowadays doesn't exist in nice, convenient, big old pools that come up as gushers. Is that right?
It's true. Well, there never were. Okay, these pools of oil are myths. Okay, what those were, if you go back to the old pictures of East Texas, you know, Spindletop, and if you've seen that old movie Giant, where the oil comes spewing out of the ground, even in those cases, the oil was not in a pool. What the oil was trapped inside rock under very high pressure. And when they drilled the well into that rock, they created a void, and the pressure forced the oil out into that void and up the pipe into the surface, where it blew out all over the place. And that pressure traditionally was caused by gas, natural gas. It's entrained, it's trapped with the oil, or it's above the oil in the rock formation. So there aren't any pools of oil down there. It's all trapped in rock, or it's trapped in some kind of a sand. The commonest oil-bearing formations are sandstones. In Texas, we also have a very famous formation called the Austin Chalk, which is a limestone, or strapped in shales. There's of course other types of rock that trap oil as well, but those are the common ones. And it's pressure that forces it to the surface. And when you have a very small surface area to push that oil out of, you don't get very much. If you increase that surface area, then you get more oil out because there's just more space to push the oil through. It takes less energy to push a given volume of oil out. And that's where hydraulic fracturing really was developed, the very old technology. It's not a new technology at all. The first well was actually fractured back in 1947 in Kansas. So this is not a new technology. It's been done on thousands and thousands of oil wells and gas wells.
Grew up on in a part of Texas that's on top of Austin Chalk when I was in South Texas, and when I would play along the creek when I was a boy, I noticed that there were places that oil just naturally seeped up from the ground. And actually, we had the Shell Oil Company come out, and they paid my father $60 to look for oil on the property and didn't find anything that they could drill for. What keeps oil in the ground? Why doesn't it contaminate oil, water all the time? Is it the pressure, the downward pressure, all the rock?
Yeah. There's pressure, so, and there's also just a lot of rock on top of the oil that keeps it in place.
So
yeah, even in the shallowest oil reservoirs, you're looking at 500 feet of rock from the surface. Now, there are a few places in the world where you do have oil actually produced on the surface. The most famous of those in the United States are the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. And they still produce oil off.
For the most part,
oil is found pretty deep in the ground.
So you have to go down about 500 feet or so. I guess what I want to ask you is, I see all these horrible pictures of what happens in fracking oil wells. Why doesn't that happen with every oil well? I mean, an oil well isn't just a hole in the ground, is it?
No. The oil wells that are drilled are all cased with steel casing, and that casing is cemented in place. It's steel pipe. And one reason that it's cemented in place is to keep the pressure that's in the ground from pushing that pipe out, and then that pipe would then be gone, and the oil could potentially contaminate freshwater aquifers that are not so deep in the ground. Your typical aquifer in Texas runs between 100 to 200 feet. In East Texas, they're shallower. In West Texas, they're deeper. But around here, you're looking at about a 200 to 300 foot well for fresh water. And one reason that the Railroad Commission requires this is if there is an aquifer present, you have to case the oil well with steel pipe in order to prevent possible contamination of freshwater aquifers.
So you're telling me that water is on top, and then there's a lot of rock between water and oil, and the process of drilling a well involves putting down steel pipes to keep the oil from getting into water. I did a little research for our talk, and I found that there have been, of all the oil wells in the United States, there have been 17 leaks in the pipes. I don't know how many wells there are in the United States. There's several hundred thousand. 17 have actually leaked. So are you saying that maybe the what you see in a documentary like Gasland did have, but it's awfully unusual?
It's vanishingly unusual. It really just doesn't happen. I mean, it has happened in the past. It occasionally, very, very rarely happens. Has hydraulic fracturing caused this? As you know, the EPA, state EPAs, the USGS has looked at this, and they just, there's been one study that's indicated there may have been contamination of an aquifer by hydraulic fracturing, and that's disputed even within the federal government. So there's just no evidence for it. And it's not that people haven't looked. People make all these comments that, you know, hydraulic fracturing is damaging, you know, of drinking water and all this, but the facts just don't support that. And it's not that people haven't looked. They've looked at this in Texas. The Railroad Commission has looked at it. They have looked at it in New York State. They've looked at it in Pennsylvania. They're continuing to look at it, and they just don't find it happening. And it upsets me because I'm a scientist and I'm an environmentalist, and I'm perfectly willing to look. I mean, I'm not saying that the oil and gas industry is not is blameless. It has caused a lot of contamination. Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, classic, terrible case of it. But the facts are the facts, and that there's just no evidence for hydraulic fracturing based on science. Now, yeah, you'll find people. The classic example, and I think this is in Gasland, where they have the water that looks red that they show in the picture. I think that's in the movie, if I remember. It's cloudy anyway. And they said, look, the fracturing caused this. Well, what this was probably done by was overpumping a water well. If you have an old water well with a steel casing and you overpump it, you take it so that it draws down below where it should be pulling water. You're taking more out of the water out of the well than you should. What happens is the water pump disturbs the sediments in the bottom of the well, and those then begin to be produced off in the water that you bring to the surface, and that's cloudy because it's rust from the steel pipe. It's, you know, whatever's fallen down or come out of the water well and fallen into it, and it comes to the surface, and you go, look, hydraulic fracturing polluted my water well. And it's bogus. It's just not true. And
what about those incidents where they lit the water, you hold up a match next to the faucet, and something catches on fire? What's going on there?
There are cases where methane, which is what is burning in that, naturally contaminates oil wells. People have looked at this as well, okay? And it's been known for many, many years that methane, because methane's a gas and it migrates easier through rock than oil does, you'll find cases where water is naturally contaminated with methane. And that's where this phenomenon is not new either. And this has been seen in water wells, in places where you have shallow deposits of methane. You also have weird, you know, strange cases where actually landfills will contaminate water wells, because landfills, which is places where people dump, you know, their waste, trash, these will start to generate methane. And there's certainly been cases where landfills have contaminated water supplies and caused methane to be produced. But again, this is not no documented case where this is coming from the effects of hydraulic fracturing.
Is it true that there are different kinds of gas that come out of landfills and organic matter in the ground, and you could tell the difference between the gas that comes out of a well and the gas that comes out of decaying stuff that happened to be around the water well?
Yes. There are technologies for telling the difference between those. You can look at the different isotopes of carbon that are found in methane. And in organically produced methane, you will get an enrichment of the lighter carbon isotopes, because this is one of the things that happens when microorganisms work on carbon. They tend to like to utilize the lighter isotopes more than the heavier ones. So C12, which is the most common carbon isotope, gets enriched, and C13, which is the heavier isotope, is progressively depleted by microbial action. And in geologically produced methane, you get an enrichment of, or there's a relatively higher ratio of C13 over C12.
So there's a different kind of carbon in the hydrocarbon.
That. Yeah, there are techniques for doing that. And again, using those techniques, the incidence of stuff that's traceable to unusual sources of methane, like coming from a deep natural gas reservoir, like, say, the Marcellus Shale, there's very little evidence of that in water aquifers as well.
So you're telling me that there's more than one way you can have gas coming out of the water in your faucet. And
sometimes
stuff just rots, and sometimes stuff just rots around a water well. But the gas that is deeper under the rock in the ground is a different sort of thing. So what about the process of fracturing? We see the testimony of I think it was some guy from Halliburton, I'm really not sure, reading off the list of chemicals, and you'd have to know what the chemicals are, like putting antifreeze. It was the first thing the guy in Gasland mentioned, was the ethylene glycol. Pouring antifreeze down a well, or pouring arsenic down a well. Is that what you do?
No, we don't. Our products don't have any of those. They're all natural products. They're all of microbial origin. Again, you have to look at the amounts of those chemicals that are used and where they're placed. And you have to look at the nature of crude oil itself. And crude oil itself is not a benign substance. It's full of a lot of things that aren't really healthy either. I'm not a blind proponent of oil and gas production either, as you know.
Personally, I prefer that we ran everything on hydrogen and not hydrogen we get from a coal-powered plant, but hydrogen from sunlight and electrolysis and putting up solar panels over your garage. And I think maybe someday we will come to that. Iceland and Denmark will probably come to it in our lifetime. But, Yes, Dr. Schneider?
Hello?
Yes, Dr.
Yes, I'm here.
But you were going to say that you're not just a blind proponent of all things oil and gas.
I'm not. I'm all for supporting even subsidies for electric, solar-powered electrics, wind power. I'm all for those. I think we need to move toward sustainable power, but we're in this gap. And we're in a situation, the world's a dangerous place. And I think we've seen in the past 15 years where we've spent vast amounts of the country's money basically defending foreign oil supplies. And not just money, but the lives of our best. And we have the prospect in this country, through hydraulic fracturing of these large shale oil reservoirs that we're finding in Texas and North Dakota and places like that, where in the next 10 years the U.S. would be basically energy independent and perhaps even a petroleum exporter. And this is good for the United States. And it provides us a bridge where we don't have to go off in these foreign adventures to protect, you know, Saudi Arabia's oil or whatever from whoever. And in the meantime, we can continue a transition to more sustainable sources. And within that context, also transitioning really much more polluting technologies like coal over to natural gas, which is a much cleaner fuel. Now, is it the ultimate end-all fuel? I think you're absolutely right. I think hydrogen is the ultimate end-all fuel that we need to move toward, and electricity. But we're not there yet. And changing the entire infrastructure over to this is going to require new technologies. It's going to require a vast investment. And the more oil that we produce and the more natural gas that we produce provide the funds to let this happen then over the next 20 or 30 years. And so I have strong feelings about this. People do not grasp the magnitude of what's happening in oil production in the United States. These are vast reservoirs. The Eagle Ford is the second largest, probably the second largest oil reservoir found since the big field in East Texas, the Woodbine. And the Bakken is bigger than that, the one in North Dakota, and it extends up into Canada. And these are, as I think I've told you, these are geopolitical game changers for the world. And they're of enormous benefit to the United States. And
you're basically saying that we don't... You know, mm-hmm. Yes.
On a personal note, it's gratifying for me, having grown up in South Texas, which is one of the poorer parts of the state. When you drive down there now, it's prosperous. I mean, there's vast new opportunities being opened up for the citizens down there that were never available in my youth, just because of the wealth that's coming there because of the Eagle Ford. And it's a shame that we don't hear enough about that. Because we really are in a new oil boom in Texas and really in the United States. And gas as well. I'm not discounting natural gas at all. But these reservoirs like the Utica and the Marcellus Shale are huge. And they're triggering a manufacturing boom in the Northeast because of cheaper power than they've ever had available and cleaner power than they ever had available. And I think it's great. I have really no reservations about it at all. But they're not the final solution. We have to keep working on wind power. We have to keep working on solar power. We have to keep working on hydrogen and the transitional technologies that are involved in those, because those are the ultimate answer.
Well, basically you're saying there's vastly more money to be made by converting over to sustainable fuels, because we have to build the infrastructure. All the gas stations have to be replaced by electrical outlets and hydrogen compressors. All the cars have to be built differently. All the transmission lines have to be done differently. It's just a complete change of technology. So you're saying that if we gave up technologies like fracking, that it wouldn't come faster, it would be slower? To move to this where we want to go?
Where's the money going to come from for it? The thing is that the money has to come from somewhere to invest in all these new technologies, and this is a great opportunity for the country. If we don't have to spend money on buying foreign oil, then there's more money available to invest in infrastructure. more money to invest in mass transit. Why don't we have a high-speed rail network in the United States? That all takes money, and the money for this can come from the new discoveries in oil and gas that are taking place, and that's where it will come from. It's the brightest spot in our economy right now.
Well, I'm not being an impartial observer or interviewer, partially because I grew up part of my childhood in a part of Texas not too far from where you did. And in my household, we had a refrigerator, we had an electric light bulb, we had a fan, a little fan that sat on the floor. We kept the windows open in the summer, and we closed them in the winter. Chased cattle, gathered eggs from chickens, couldn't afford to go to the store, things like that. My family lived on $75 a month when we lived in South Texas. And I gathered that until rather recently, that was pretty common. But with inflation, of course, it might be up to $400 or $500 a month. And you're certainly looking at changes for people involved in the industry, but what would you say to people that say that, well, you know, that's nice for you people in Texas and the people in North Dakota, or maybe it's not. Maybe it brings all the problems with prosperity. What would you say to the people that say there's just no role for hydraulic fracking in the energy future of the United States? What would you tell the people like that?
Why? there already is. I mean, it's an academic argument. I mean, there are something like 500 to 1,000 oil wells being drilled in the Eagleford every month in Texas. Every one of those is hydraulically fractured.
So all of the oil wells in this new field?
In the Eagleford, they're all fractured, yeah.
And
they have
10% of the energy using, 10% of the oil used in the United States? Something like that?
I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's going up all the time. And this is also true for the Marcellus Shale, which is in the Midwest. It's true for the Utica, which goes in New York and Pennsylvania. It's true for the Bakken. All those wells are fractured. They've been drilling these wells for the past 3 or 4 years with really minor environmental problems. There have been some surface spills. If they say there's no role in it, they're looking backwards, or they're closing the barn door after the cow's already got out. happening, it's not just going to happen here. You know, there's shale oil deposits in Russia. There's shale oil deposits in Europe. There's stuff in Africa. There's stuff in South America, and they're all going to use hydraulic fracturing to get that out, to get the oil out and the gas out. And it's people, you know, they oppose it, and they, you know, they try to stop it, but it's just happening, and it's successful, and the environmental results, the environmental consequences are minimal. And this bothers me. It bothers me that people are so, they get so vehement about things like this. And gee, we're committing a multitude of environmental sins much worse. Let's go to single-use plastic bottle. If you want to talk about something that's environmentally awful. I mean, this is wiping out entire populations of sea turtles and stuff like this in the oceans. The oceans are clogged with plastic. And there should be a worldwide ban on single-use plastic bottles. But there's no outcry about that, or if the outcry is there, it's minimal. We go after fracking because there I go to who would benefit from stopping hydraulic fracturing. Who would benefit?
Who would benefit?
Well, okay. The domestic oil producers wouldn't benefit. The United States wouldn't benefit. Europe gets most of its oil from either Russia or the Middle East. They don't really care. I mean, they don't get a lot of oil from us. They get some refined hydrocarbon products, but minimal. South Americans wouldn't care. The Chinese want us to make more oil because we compete for the Chinese for global oil supplies because we're an oil importer like they are. The Chinese are all for us, you know, doing hydraulic fracturing. The only group in the world that's really opposed to hydraulic fracturing on a geopolitical basis is the Middle East. And I think we have a statement here just this past week from one of the Saudi princes about what a great threat the Bakken was to Saudi Arabia. And I think that's where the, go back to the Latin phrase, cui bono, who's going to benefit from this? And the great benefit factor is the United States. I mean, it's going to take us back to where we were in energy supplies back to the early 60s, when we were an oil exporter. But the Middle East doesn't like it. It shrinks their role on the world stage. They don't have the leverage over us that they used to. And I think you have to look very hard about where the support is for stopping hydraulic fracturing. I think you really do. And nobody does. And that's a shame.
Well, I've also seen figures that the actual cost of a gallon of gasoline is about $15 to $16 per gallon in the United States. For our listeners outside the United States, that's $4 a liter. Due to the amount of money we spend in the military in the Middle East, that basically is a matter of protecting oil fields that export to us. And if we didn't have to import the oil, if we didn't import the oil, we got it domestically supplied, we wouldn't have to spend that extra $12 a gallon on the military, not to mention the countless lives.
Exactly. That's the terrible thing, that we send the people that are our best people, and they die or they're maimed for life, for oil. And I really think that's terrible that we have to do that. And that's another reason I'm all for, you know, drill, baby, drill, because this can change things for this country. We can turn things around, and we don't have to go off on these foreign adventures. And, you know, if some of the oil from the Middle East is exported to the U.S., it's really not that much. Most of it ends up going to Europe or to China. But the more oil that you get into the global market, the bigger cushion there is. Because and people always tell me, I read a really kind of nonsensical interview with one of my fellow professors at UT about this, about how expensive it is to produce oil from shale. And that's true. It does cost more money. And that's why oil is more expensive. And that's not really true, because that doesn't set oil prices. Oil prices are set by oil traders and the big banks, and it's based on demand. It's how much oil is being pulled out of the market. And the big growth in demand, as you know, is coming from China, it's coming from India, and because they have economies that are growing 3 or 4 times faster than ours is. And yes, we do use a lot of energy in the U.S., there's no doubt about that, but the demand on oil comes from these economies. It's not just from the U.S. And Brazil, too. I mean, Brazil is a player in this as well.
So I guess you're saying that if you really want to stop fracking, go out and go ahead and get your Chevy Volt or your Tesla or rig up a hydrogen car from, build one in your garage. Go ahead and turn up... Yeah, change your thermostat, do the things that consume less energy, and there will be less demand, and people won't do as much fracking, but you don't see that happening, do you?
No, not yet. I mean, it's going to come. And like I said, I'm all for, you know, a lot of people, I get a lot of criticism because you'll say, because I'm in favor of subsidizing things like electric cars. I'm in favor of subsidizing wind power. I mean, I have had arguments with my representative about this. Because he said, well, you know, wind turbines actually cost more money to make electricity than they bring in because the maintenance costs are so high. And I said, wind turbines are in their infancy. We're going to get better at making them. They're going to work better. But you only find out that by building them. Same thing with electric cars. People say, oh, electric cars, and they only go 100 miles or whatever. We're just at the beginning of building those. And people say, oh, yeah, we had electric cars 100 years ago. Well, yeah, that's true. But they didn't have the technology that we have. And so to develop those, you have to give them an impetus. It's a good thing for everybody to have a cleaner way to get around. We need to have high-speed rail in the United States that's electric-based or natural gas-powered or whatever. We need to start working on that. And we need to put a lot more money into that. We need to have high-speed rail in Texas, and it needs to be sustainably powered. And we're not spending money enough on those things because, of course, we have the airline lobby. They don't want to have high-speed rail in Texas because they want to keep the airline market. But what's better for the country? What's better for the country is to have a sustainably powerful system for moving people around. And
well, what's better for the environment to have jets or to have trains? You're a professor of sciences. Which works better for the environment?
The cheapest way to move freight is with trains. And it's more environmentally sound to use a diesel locomotive to move freight. If you're looking at amount of carbon produced per pound of freight, use a diesel locomotive, even when you see the black smoke coming out when they start up. It's still the cheapest way to move stuff. And it's a lot better for the environment than an airplane. And we've allowed our railroad infrastructure in the U.S. to deteriorate. And it's a shame. We need to work toward a system more like what Europe has. Europe has excellent high-speed rail service all over Europe now. And eventually, all those diesels could be replaced with electrics. And that's what we should be spending our money, and not on more highways.
I guess, Dennis,
we're spending on highways.
Offend all our listeners by being against highways and for fracking and for alternative energy. I do want to get back to just a little bit on what it is you particularly do. I think it's fascinating how you use bacteria to open up an oil well. How does that work?
Well, it uses the same ideas as the older technologies that use chemicals. And what we do is we look for bacteria that produce biochemicals. These are all naturally occurring bacteria. We don't genetically engineer any of them, but they produce the same sorts of chemicals that behave the same way as the ones that the chemical industry gets from crude oil. And they're solvents. They're small molecules that dissolve in the oil, and they make the oil thinner. They produce compounds that behave as detergents, as surfactants. So they pull things off of rock, and so they make the oil flow better out of the ground. And it's something we've been doing. This week is my 25th year working in this area, and it works. It's a viable alternative to using oil-filled chemicals.
So you don't genetically modify anything. You're using bacteria that already exist in nature. They already exist somewhere in the ground, I guess?
Yeah.
Where did you collect your bacteria?
Oh, from all over the place. We look at marine sources. We look in extreme environments for certain of them. All kinds of places.
Like a geyser or something? Or?
You could get them. Yeah, we've isolated ones from hot springs. We've isolated ones, by a few from oil wells, surprisingly not very many from oil wells, from marine environments, all kinds of marine environments. We used to spend a lot of time on this. We don't so much because we've kind of got a mature product line and we kind of have a lot of stuff to sell, and more of our energies are devoted to sales and marketing now than they were to R&D. But we still do a bit of it. Excuse me. Got a little bit of a cold today.
Well, I do find it fascinating that the chemicals, or at least some of the kind smaller molecules, the simpler chemicals that might get pumped into an oil well, turn out to be things that nature itself makes. And
absolutely.
The bacteria you put into the oil well are just multiplying a process that occurs naturally on a much, much smaller scale. So everything about chemicals isn't bad, obviously. I guess there are, as you were saying, there are also problems with oil itself, that oil itself is pretty toxic. If you were to stick your hand in a barrel of crude, that would not be a good thing. Or,
It's not the best thing that you can do. Certain oils are more toxic than others. That's a lot of people think crude oils are all the same, and they vary tremendously in their chemical composition. And some contain a much higher level of carcinogenic compounds than others. So they do vary considerably. But people talk to me about exposure to carcinogens. Everybody is aware of this, carcinogens in food, whatever. And I said, well, when you fill your car up with gasoline, I said, do you breathe the fumes? And he said, well, it's right there by the pump. You can't help it. And I said, well, you're breathing in a carcinogen then, because you're breathing benzene. Benzene's found in all gasoline. So it's another reason to shift away from using gas-powered vehicles.
So it's interesting to hear someone in the oil and gas business saying that we really need to get away from the oil and gas business, that we really need to go to these alternative fuels. But while we're doing it, what we need to avoid doing is maintaining armies in the Middle East, spending fortunes, killing people, killing far more people of other countries than our own. And of course, it's a tragedy that we lose our own veterans. We cannot replace lives, but we can at least get the energy here, where we don't have to fund the armies, where we have environmental watchdogs, where we have people like Greenpeace asking questions about what we are doing and whether we should be doing it. And I'm guessing that there isn't any the environmental watchdog group in some of these other countries where they produce oil. Is that true?
Not much, not in my experience. And I've traveled through most of those places, and I've seen environmental horror stories that would make the Deepwater Horizon event, well, not as bad as the Deepwater Horizon event, but certainly as any environmental consequence of hydraulic fracturing look like nothing. Okay, I mean they're just horrendous throughout the Middle East. There's horrendous environmental destruction from crude oil production. You know, the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, is basically a cesspool of oil dumping. You know, that and has been for 50 years. I mean, people talk about what happened in the first Iraq War, you know, when all the oil from the wells got into the Persian Gulf. But I said, oil's been dumped in the Persian Gulf for much longer than that, and they have vast areas in Saudi and in Kuwait that are impacted from crude oil spills. They just cover them up with sand. You know, they don't do anything about them. And many other oil-producing countries I've been to, it's the same way. And then you contrast that with if they have a spill in the Eagle Ford, which they've had a few small ones, what they do is they basically shut down production until the spill can be cleaned up. It's a much, much better way to produce oil than the way it's done in a lot of other countries. And another reason why you need to bring the production here, because we, despite everything you want to say about the oil and gas industry, they do want to do it in as environmentally safe fashion as possible. And, yeah, they do make mistakes. They make colossal mistakes like the Deepwater Horizon. But most of those guys want to do a good job. And if you've ever known anybody, and I know I have many friends in the oil and gas industry, these are serious, hardworking people. They're not people that want to pollute the environment. They want to do a good job. And I can give many examples where they have stopped production either for safety reasons or for environmental reasons so that things could be done in the right way. And it's not to say they haven't made a lot of mistakes in the past and continue to make some mistakes. But in this country, the will is there to make oil and gas production as safe as possible environmentally. And it's not the case in all these other places. No, they'll say
well, Dr.
that. But, you know. Yes.
Well, Dr. Snyder, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I really appreciate your patience and the patience of our listeners in dealing with our technical problems. I hope that I'd love to have you again with all our technical problems worked out. And I hope that my listeners come back next week to Steady Health Radio on the BBS network. I'm Robert Reister signing off. Thank you for listening, and visit us on steadyhealth.com. See you next week.